You are listening to a podcast from Dundalk FM, Dundalk's local community radio station. Do get in contact if you would like to find out how to join our team of sports, music, news and current affairs community broadcasters on dundalkfm.com or find us on Facebook.
Good afternoon and welcome to Conversations with Dundalk Toastmasters. I'm your host, Mark, and I'm joined with Michael and Tony. And thank you for listening. First of all, I'll talk about Toastmasters and our experiences of it. Dundalk Toastmasters was formed in 2005, chartered in 2006, and it continues to go from strength to strength. The club meets on the first and third Monday of each month between September and June inclusive. No meetings are held on bank holiday Mondays. They take place on the Tuesday of that week instead, and meetings commence at 8 p.m. in Fairways Hotel Dundalk. It's pretty much a safe and warm environment for one to practice public speaking and socialise, and has all age groups. So I'll just tell you a bit about my experience of it. I had a terrible fear of public speaking to such an extent that my knees used to pretty much buckle and my voice used to shake, and one time I had to kneel down with a laptop covering me so I wouldn't be seen by the crowd, as opposed to present to the screen behind me. Since then, I have gone to Toastmasters. After my first time of speaking at Toastmasters, my voice was still shaking, but it got better and better with time. I was on the radio after my first Toastmasters, and I thought my voice was shaking, but I listened back to it, and it sounded okay, so it gave me confidence to go on. And since then, I have been sent to Las Vegas and Baltimore to host workshops with work. So a huge transition and a big change in my life, and I'd just like to ask Michael and Tony of their experiences too.
Well, I joined Toastmasters, it must be about two years ago, and it's for similar reasons than why you joined. I was terrified of public speaking. I remember when it came to public speaking at school, I would be sick. I would fall sick around that period, just avoid speaking in public. But 2 years ago, I was talking to a friend about this, and he mentioned Dundalk Toastmasters. And lo and behold, then the next week, there was an advertisement in the Northern Standard. And he goes, well, the Toastmasters is advertising for the start of the year in Dundalk. Why don't the two of us go to it? So he called around to the house, and so then that was the start. I went then, and about 2 years ago, and I've completed just... 2 months ago, I've just completed 10 speeches. So that's the, if you get 10 speeches, that's sort of, you get a recognition, a kind of your completion of your first assignment books and that. So so far, it's a good experience, and certainly glad I joined. And how about you, Michael?
Yes, well, good afternoon, listeners. And just like Mark and Tony's experience, I was terrified really of public speaking, and it had got to a stage I was asked to chair a meeting at work, and I could barely speak, and I had a dry mouth and I was very, very nervous altogether. So my brother suggested that I go to Toastmasters. He had heard of it through a friend, so I attended my first meeting just about 6 months ago, just before Christmas. And at the first meeting, I happened to know a few people from work that were also attending, and they asked me to take up a job that was the R counter at the next meeting. And the job of the R counter is to look out for crush words like ahs and ums and you knows, things that you're trying to eliminate. And that kind of broke the ice for me, and shortly afterwards I joined the club in Dundalk. I have to say the people there have been fantastic, very supportive, very understanding, and they give you great feedback. Again, you're always getting plenty of positive, constructive feedback from other people that's at the meeting. And I just completed my third speech there 2 weeks ago, so really looking forward to when we come back in September and getting going on project 4 and 5.
Very good, thank you. So Toastmasters now has a summer break in July and August, so we'll be commencing again on the first Monday of September at 8 in the Fairways, and you're more than welcome to come along for a look. So today we'll be talking about the World Cup, just to whet your appetite, and Michael Woods will be talking about people in new jobs. Oops. And Tony will be talking about trends and cycles. So just first of all, I'll give you some facts about the World Cup. There are 32 teams and 64 matches, and Germany will play their 100th World Cup game ever when playing Portugal. Bosnia and Herzegovina is the only country to have ever qualified for the first time, and before it, they and Honduras were the only teams in it to have never won a World Cup match. It will be the first World Cup with goal line technology, and that's not ahead of time, but sometimes they use it a bit too often. In this one, I've seen the ball rattle the back of the net, and they still revert to the goal technology.
Has it been actually used in this World Cup?
I haven't seen a match where it has.
I've seen one, the first France game, and Benzema scored, it hit the post and it wasn't going over the line, but the keeper kind of fumbled it on the line.
Okay.
But it was handy in that case. It proved that the ball had completely crossed the line, and in a split second decision for a referee, that'd be very difficult to see from outside the box.
Did the ref have to do the hand signal?
I didn't see him do that. It was the RTE that went straight for the goal tag. Goal line technology, or whoever was providing the pictures.
Yeah, like not ahead of time, yes. And also Ricky Martin will be performing the winning song of the World Cup, so we look forward to that. And it's the most expensive World Cup of all time. It costs the cost so far about between 14 and 16 billion US dollars. Now, in relation to the last five World Cups, in 1994 it was 30 million. In the USA. In 1998, in France, it was 340 million. 2002, Japan and South Korea, 5 billion. And 2006, Germany, 6 billion. And 2010, South Africa, 4 billion. So, what is really interesting to see is that in 2014, it was way more expensive than the two previous World Cups together, and almost as expensive as the last three World Cups. With that, FIFA has scrapped the World Cup speeches to avoid protests, and protests and booing are due to the corruption allegations and high costs. So there is a dark side to it, and I'd just like to go through a bit of it with you. I was there at Christmas time and spoke to many people who did not welcome it coming there. They said that they need better healthcare, education and standard of living, not more or better stadiums. The estimated cost of the World Cup will in fact equal to just over 60% of the country's education budget, and the revenue that will be created will not be evenly distributed. People are being thrown out of their homes by authorities to make way for infrastructure and accommodate visitors. With a poverty rate of 15,000, about 11 million British citizens have no other choice but to live in favelas, which are slums or shanty towns. Now around 170,000 of them are being treated or threatened or faced with evictions as more roads and buildings are being constructed. While Brazil is notorious for having high eviction rates, there's no doubt that the intense preparation for the World Cup only makes matters worse for those who are being kicked out of their places they've called home for years. So protests and threats of terrorism have been issued. The gangs who are notorious there and have executed hundreds of police have promised a World Cup of Terror, planning to hold up, rob and kidnap visitors and to make kidnap visitors. But make no mistake, it's virtually impossible for a country to host such a major event without some sort of economic and social challenges and changes. But the Brazilian government, FIFA and football fans are demonstrating that our international obsession for sports is swiftly taking over our compassion for our fellow human beings. People are literally losing their freedom and lives to protest the issues that have been brought by the World Cup, and yet their causes are being looked over to allow others to cheer on athletes whose salaries could single-handedly bring thousands of Brazilians out of poverty. At this point, it's too late for the World Cup to stop from happening in Brazil, but the least we can do is show the world that our love for each other is greater than our love for sports. So with that, I'll turn to the two lads here and ask them about, maybe they can lighten the mood if they like and talk about their experiences of the World Cup and what they think of the World Cup, or even talk about the issues that I have just spoken about.
Well, lad, yes, some brilliant points mentioned there by Mark. I too visited Brazil in my case was last summer when I visited Rio, and a lot of the local people that we spoke to, and taxi drivers and people that worked in the bars and restaurants where we visited, didn't want the World Cup, and they didn't want the Olympics either, because of the stress was putting on the country's finances. And again, just like what Mark mentioned, a lot of people are looking to education as a way of maybe bettering the standards of living in the country over a longer period of time, and many of the people did suggest that money would have been far better. We all know that Brazil is fantastic at football, but for Brazilians themselves that are living in dire poverty, maybe don't even have shoes to put on their feet or food to put on the table for their families, they thought that hospitals and taking care of the real social problems in the country was what that money should have been spent on. It's when we talk about billions, each of those billions, as we know in this country, to get a billion euro or a billion US dollars takes a lot of cuts somewhere else to get that money. So obviously people being displaced from their homes, it's mm-hmm. not anything that we like to see, and when it's done in the name of something that we're all supposed to enjoy, it's very hypocritical, really, when you look at that.
Yeah, some very good points there, Michael. That was my experience too. They said that they needed better education and better health services, not more football stadiums. So, Tony, would you like to talk about what you see here? Or
well, you mentioned the protest that's going on in Brazil regarding the corruption and that, and worldwide there's sort of an uptick of unrest and protests, civil unrest, you could call it, a civil unrest cycle that's going on right now. If you look at Ukraine, it's sort of civil unrest, and possibly it's teetering on war. Civil unrest in Thailand just a few weeks ago, the military has declared martial law. Then you have the protests in Brazil and Venezuela, Italy, there's some protests going on there, Portugal, and then we had the Wall Street. So corruption on that at a worldwide scale, it's huge. But I know the World Cup is meant to be happy and that. Myself, I didn't get to see many games. I saw a few highlights, and but I was just thinking on the way up. I know you mentioned that you want to talk about the World Cup, and I was trying to think back what was my best memories of the World Cup. Well, for me, it's the Italia 90, the World Cup of 1990 against in Italy. Apparently, there's a urban legend or urban myth that some Irish guys went out to support the team never came back. And, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I remember that, yeah, against Italy, Italy that put us out, or yeah, and then there's famous players, Scalacci and stuff like that. World Cup, I think it's meant to be positive, and it's unfortunate that there is a little bit of protest going on right now in Brazil. So that's my sort of take on the World Cup.
I suppose another point is, it is a huge way of, it's a great way to generate income for a country as well, the tourism, and there will be a knock-on effect for Brazil, I hope, from people looking at images on their television sets and saying, oh, that's looks like a fantastic place to visit, and hopefully that will recoup a lot of the cost. But the figures that you've mentioned, it will take them quite a long time. But in saying that, the standard of football, I've been watching it now religiously every night, and as a fan of the German national team, I had a great day now watching the 4-0 win over Portugal, and I'm hoping for good stuff from the German team, and I also like watching the Italian and the French teams, so they're all going strong at the minute, so hopefully.
Did you put a wager on any of these teams?
It's not my style. But I'd be afraid to lose. But no, I think the standard of football is great, and it's a great showcase of the sport, and from the matches I've watched, it's been played in the fantastic sporting spirit, with the exception maybe of Honduras against France. Some of the tackles in that game were pretty nasty, but with the exception of that, it's been played at a...
There's been a lot of goals, hasn't there?
Yeah, and some fantastic goals as well. Robin van Persie's first goal against Spain was just absolutely fantastic to watch. You just watch it over and over again. So there is a good side to the World Cup as well, and hopefully there'll be many more memories made for people that visit there as well.
And it's not over yet.
No, it's not. It's not even out of the group. So plenty more action to come.
Very good, yes. And I suppose an awareness of the problems and awareness of Brazil itself might bring more visitors, and it could end up, like Michael says, it could end up to be a good team maybe over time. So, first of all, we'll play a bit of music. It's by Rory Gallagher. He was born in 2nd of March 1948. He was an Irish blues rock multi-instrumentalist. Born in Ballyshannon, County Donegal, and raised in Cork. And his album sold in excess of 30 million copies worldwide. He received a liver transplant in 1995, but died of complications later that year at the age of 47. And my favourite fact about him is, in an interview, Jimi Hendrix was asked what it's like to be the greatest guitarist of all time, and he says, "I don't know." He said, "I don't know. Ask Rory Gallagher." And there's a festival every year in Ballyshannon. I've been to that one a few times, and in Cork. I haven't been there, but I'd definitely recommend them. So we'll start off with, I couldn't find my favourite or my second favourite song of his last night, so we'll start off with Bad Penny. Thank you. Welcome back, listeners. I'm Mark with Conversations with Toastmasters. I'll hand you over to Michael with his topic of emotions of a new job.
Thank you very much, Mark, and good afternoon again, listeners. Welcome back to our show. And what I'm going to speak to you about today is just the emotions that people go through when they start a new job. It's especially over the last 5 or 6 years with the recession and people start maybe going into a new job that they've never been in before. You know, it's quite a common thing at the moment. And even during the week, someone quite close to me was telling me that they were applying for a new job and they were very excited about it. And even the application stage is a lot of different emotions for people, because they have to look back at a CV that they mightn't have updated maybe in 3 or 4 years. And even living back through the last couple of years and trying to add to that CV, of course, then there's the small things like going down to the stationery shop to get some nice paper for it, and there's all sorts of things that you have to think of. And am I making a good impression? And when it comes to the interview stage, then what type of clothes am I wearing? What's this saying about me? My hairstyle, what's that saying about me? Am I wearing jewellery? So there's all those very small things, and it's something we're all very conscious of when we go into an interview situation. But that's only really the beginning for the trouble for some people. Now, I'm not suggesting for a second here that starting a new job is a bad thing. It's a wonderful thing, and it's full of excitement for us all. And we get that phone call, we might get a letter in the post, and it's really an exciting time when you get that, when you get the word that, wow, I impressed them in an interview. This is fantastic. And it's so exciting at first, but our first day, it's another challenge for a lot of people. In your first year, we tend to go through a lot of sometimes scary emotions, sometimes fantastic emotions, but it really is a roller coaster for the first year. So today what I'm going to be speaking about is just that first year. What's it like for most people? Now, our new members, of course, in Toastmasters, we spoke earlier on at the beginning of the show about what it's like to go through the first doorway in the fair. Is that first night, what it's like. You don't know anybody, or you might go in my case, and realise that you actually did know somebody there. But that's a scary experience in itself. So all our new members know what that's like, and our guests that come to our meetings, they know what it's like, that sense of anxiety before you go through the door. But when we step outside that comfort zone and we try something new, it usually works out well. So that is the good news. So again, of course, I spoke there about the happiness. But a lot of people over the last 5 or 6 years, I've spoken to a lot of friends, family, people that I've worked with, have maybe upskilled or retrained. Maybe they're fresh out of college to start a new job, and they give me a feeling of God, am I in over my head here? Am I going to sink or am I going to swim? So we kind of feelings of helplessness as well. There was a very interesting piece of research done a few years ago in America, actually, by a psychologist called Yamamoto and his associates. And what they found was that there was four or five different emotions that we all go through. This is also backed up by works of others like Philip Austin in England in the 90s. And five main groups of responses that we have to a new job. The first one is anger and frustration, and that shocked me when I heard that, because I've had a few jobs at this stage and I've never felt angry about starting a new job. But what can happen is maybe we've bought in a set of expectations or a set of standards that we set for ourselves from a previous experience, and we want those same standards in a new workplace. So we could go into a new workplace and the standard could be really, really high, and we don't know if we could feel under a lot of pressure, and that can make us angry and frustrated at ourselves and with others. And the second thing that they commented on was anxiety. I mentioned that, but the anxiety can also follow through to things like trying new things for the first time. So that might be maybe working at the reception for the first time for some person. It might be dealing with a lot of paperwork for the first time for another person. So what happens there is a thing called imposter syndrome. It's a very interesting thing, imposter syndrome. It's when we feel like we're incapable of doing the job and we're worried that people's going to find out about it. We're going to be found out in some way that we're bad at doing this particular task. That tends to be more prominent in younger people, and actually in females, amongst females as well. It's very common thing to have. But of course, usually after a year or two, when we get used to doing the new job and we get compliments from the people that we work with, we realise, God, you know, I'm actually not that bad at doing this. So maybe I'm not an imposter at the end of the day. The third thing that we get is embarrassment and guilt, and I wondered about that one for a long time, and I read some more on this, and this is more common amongst people that have been promoted rather than entering a new workplace. And we forget sometimes that when someone that we work with gets a promotion, that they can feel embarrassed about that. They can feel quite uncomfortable that one day they were our colleague, maybe they started the same day of us, maybe they went to school with us, and now they have to ask us to do stuff. And that can give lots of feelings of guilt as well. God, you know, I'm asking this person to do something, and you know, I used to do it myself. The people that have been promoted, they worry a lot about what is this person going to think of me now? Do they think I'm going to try and boss them around? And there are two others, of course. Isolation. That's a huge one for people in a new workplace as well. Feelings of isolation that stem from being the new kid on the block. So you walk in the first day and you don't know that maybe Paul doesn't like Anne, or Anne had a fight last week with Mary and they're not talking at the moment. And there's a feeling of isolation of, God, I actually haven't a clue what this workplace is all about. And, you know, you can feel on your own for a time, or maybe people have been friends for a long time. You might go into a place of work that there's two or three other people working and they've been working together for 5 years or maybe 10 years or 20, and you're a new kid in the block. You don't know their family's names. You don't know all those personal stories that you build up over 20 years of a relationship at work with somebody. So those feelings of isolation are there in the first year as well. And I'm happy to report that there is some happiness as well. So listeners, you might think I'm getting very morbid today, but there is a lot of happiness as well. Of course, just the feeling that, of course, for a lot of people, maybe they're starting a new job, they've been promoted. Maybe they're starting a new job having been unemployed for a time. Maybe they're starting their first ever job. And the feelings of self-worth and happiness that we get from that somebody has taken a chance on me, somebody thinks I must be good at this, or I have the potential to be good at this. So we do get a lot of feelings of happiness. So I suppose to conclude on this, what can we do in our workplaces, or maybe not even in our workplaces, in our clubs, in our societies, in our communities, when somebody new moves into the area or somebody new starts with us in our club or our job? Well, I suppose the main thing we can do, according to these psychologists, are one of two things. Number one, we can make them a cup of tea. Believe it or not, they say that making a cup of tea for someone is actually one of the best things you can do at work, because it makes them feel as if they're part of a family, or they're part of something more that's just sharing the same floor space. And the second thing we can do is pay them plenty of compliments, because what I spoke about there a few moments ago, imposter syndrome, feeling that we cannot do the job. How do we know that that's not true unless somebody tells us that we can? So I suppose what we can all do is sit down beside the new person at their lunch break, ask them how they're getting on, find out a bit more about them, and tell them a few stories as well about what it's like to work here. You know, soften the feeling of anxiety for them, and then just pay them plenty of compliments, saying, you know, that's a great thing you did there, I like the way you dealt with that customer, or God, you know, fair play to you for coming here and trying a new job for the first time or stepping outside your comfort zone. So listeners, I hope you can take a few pointers from that, and if there is anybody new starting in your workplace, make sure you feel them, make them feel at home.
Absolutely, thanks for that, Michael. And one thing when you said about paying people compliments, what sprung to mind was the sandwich effect, whereas if you have to give constructive criticism, to maybe couch it in a positive. So the sandwich effect would be the two pieces of bread would be the positive and what's inside would be the constructive criticism. Another thing that popped to my mind as you were talking there is about the anger and frustration and isolation is something that I experienced myself a few years ago, and that I suppose wouldn't be talked about very often as we're adults now, but it's something very prevalent and prominent, is bullying. I was pretty much bullied by a lady as well, so it's kind of harder to tackle. And at the start, I didn't realise it was bullying because it just didn't affect me, and I just thought she was just being a bit nasty, and I didn't really mind. But as people spoke about it to me and said I wouldn't put up with that, it started to affect me. So that's something that can happen in the workplace, and it's quite prominent, and it's not like what it used to be like in secondary school, where you just would have been a guy against me, and you just go to boxing and upskill and handle it that way. It's a bit different when it's psychological.
Yeah, so that's a very interesting point, Mark. And again, 2011, another interesting piece of research by in DCU this time by Brennan and McCurk, and they suggest that there's a very low levels of emotional literacy in the workplace in Ireland in comparison to other, especially European countries. That it would work much better on this. And recently in the university that I attend at the moment in DCU, they've established an anti-bullying, the National Anti-Bullying Centre, and a piece of research that's being looked at the moment is how much bullying is taking place in Irish workplaces. And it really, some the initial findings are quite shocking, how much of it that's going on. And again, That's it's a lot more common in Irish workplaces than you would have expected, and there is a lot of that psychological bullying going on, that type of really trying to undermine a person's sense of being able to do their job, or maybe their sense of who they are, making fun of them in different ways, or trying to undermine them socially in the workplace and isolate them from the main group. So it's quite common, and it's something that's going to need some more research before we really know exactly what we're dealing with on a national basis. But again, it is a problem that's out there at the moment.
Well, in your talk there, Michael, you mentioned happiness. There was an interesting program during the week, some of you might have come across it, How to Be Happy, and Maureen Gaffney was hosting it, and she has a book out. She's sort of a psychologist, and I think she lectures maybe up in Trinity College. But dealing with happiness was interesting. At the very start of the programme, she talked about happiness, and she kind of broke down the stats that 50% of happiness was our genetics, our parents, our grandparents, which we have little or no control over, and 10% of happiness was your career and your education. Yet and all, we might spend maybe up to 90% of our time worrying about our career and our financial positions and that. And then the remaining of that stat was 40%. And 40% is how we handle and how we tackle these emotions that we experience in everyday living, everyday life. And there's a kind of a knack to it, to be, basically it comes down to becoming more self-aware, more conscious at the, you could call it the chatter, the internal chatter that's going on in our brain, and how we cope and how we tackle that, and not to dwell on that too much, and that and that can pull us down on that. But happiness, yeah, I think you have to reach a certain level of happiness when you're in a job or that.
Yeah, this sorry, Mark, go on.
You spoke about awareness there of happiness, and I was at a positive psychology event before as I studied psychology, and one of the things that they brought up, and they said it's actually more effective than Prozac, is if you keep a diary of positive things that happen. So you write down 3 things that happen a day for the first 3 weeks, positive experiences, and then after that write 3 good things that happened that week. Now I've learned a lot through going to psychology and through studying psychology, and I never put anything to the test, but I've always wanted to keep a diary. So that's one thing I've started to practice. At the very start of that event, she told us to turn to someone and tell them something that happened positive that week. And it was a very difficult thing to do, I think, as Irish people in the full week.
So you wanted to say something negative, Mark, did you?
So, like, I think as Irish people, we're trained. We're not trained, but I think we think in the negative, and it comes more naturally maybe to think in the negative and to be self-deprecating. But after a while, through diary entries, and I'd recommend it to everyone, you become more aware of the positive. You have to think of what happened to you that week, and I presume, I haven't read back on it yet, but I presume reading back on it as well would be a positive experience. But when positive things happen to you, you become more aware of it, and you realise that these things would be happening anyway, but they affect you differently because of your awareness of it. And that's just one thing that I'd recommend. It's a very powerful intervention for positive psychology.
Yeah, that's all. Like, yeah, how you handle your emotions and that, and the balance of positive and negativity. And during that program, go back to the program, they were talking about relationships, and there's actually a scientific formula that there has to be for a healthy relationship. There has to be a minimum of 3 positives for every negative. And if it falls below that, I had a 78% chance that relationship would not last beyond maybe 5 or 10 years. Oh. And I've heard similar people talk about this positive-negative emotions, and that if you hear somebody says a negative remark or a negative comment to you, that it can sometimes take a minimum of 16 to 17 positive remarks to eliminate that one negative comment.
That's very interesting that you say that. There was these call centres before, and sometimes one negative remark can, as you say, be much more damaging than 3, 4, 10 positive remarks. And bringing back to the awareness, what they did was a very inventive way. They had this machine beside them where they clicked a button if it was a positive experience and a light would go green, and they'd keep clicking. Then if they had a negative experience, they'd click a button and the light would go red. At the end of the day, they'd look at all these lights and they'd see that it's primarily green lights, so it's all couched in positive experiences, and it kind of puts it into perspective, that negative experience. So you could do that. You could have your own mental green or red lights and just become more aware of the positive.
It's very good. And I suppose, as Tony mentioned there, that And Mark has also mentioned it, that we can be more aware of those negative comments and just not pick up on the positive comments and not. And I suppose, to go back to what I had said, or the advice I'd given our listeners earlier on about people starting in the workplace, it's so important to actually tell somebody if you appreciate something, or tell someone that they're doing something well. And I suppose something maybe we should be all be aware of is how many compliments am I actually paying people. And Tony also mentioned there that our perception of an event shapes whether we think it's positive or negative. And even a simple thing like if you're waiting on someone, and Tony was waiting for me this morning before I showed up because I was a wee bit late. I told him to be here at 11, and it was 11:05, but Tony didn't get panic at all. He waited very patiently. But we often see so many people that's waiting in a restaurant for somebody, and if it's 30 seconds past the time, the phone's out, they're ringing someone, where are you? and you know, the caricature you know, of them. It's yeah. Oh God, what's happened to
do
them?
Do you know so we see that? We see that at checkouts and that.
Yeah.
Where people, some people get extremely frustrated in that. And it can be quite amusing to sort of watch how people's handling this. And it can sometimes affect the people immediately ahead of them or behind them. And they can actually turn negative. And then other people just kind of pass over remarks, might find it amusing or that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's a classic example of, yeah. of people handling their emotions at that current time. Like,
yeah, there was another interesting one. I was in the car the other day with a friend, and somebody passed us out at a dangerous junction, and we were actually turning right. And what happened was an articulated truck or a lorry passed us out. We were intended to turn right, but the way I perceived that situation was that's an experienced driver. Now maybe he's so high above the road he couldn't see the indicator. It was a bright day, maybe the sun was shining on it. I seen it happen in the mirror. I didn't think any more about it. But my friend who was in the passenger seat shouted profanities out the window at the lorry driver, and it was amazing the different perception of that. And maybe if he hadn't been driving,
well, that's
what reaction
that's
would he had?
You could say that's the ego cutting in there. Like how dare you do that? Like that's a great example of that.
But
you were much more aware and self conscious, and even though you were driving,
yeah,
and he was the backseat driver or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you're much more in control than that.
Yeah, well, I thought that maybe this lorry driver thinks I'm going very slow rather than stopping. Maybe he couldn't see that, because it was a very bright day, the sun was shining on the back of the car, and maybe it might have been difficult to see the lights. He might have thought this fella's slowing down, he's looking for someone rather than able to see the light. But it is amazing, the perception of events can change your mood so much. And
that reminds me of a story or one of my previous jobs. I was in a hardware place, and I was serving this customer, and the customer came in, and he was kind of, I knew on his body language and his facial expressions that he was irritated, things weren't going well. And he had asked, was this product, was it in? And it hadn't been in. And unbeknownst to me, this was the second time calling to find out if it had arrived in, and it hadn't. So he kind of, he lost the plot. And basically, anything that he said, or I couldn't repeat it on air on that. Mm-hmm. So I was feeling, you know, it just went on for about 2 or 3 minutes of him, like called it a bit of a hairdryer experience or that. And I was feeling, no, this was tough. He'd gone, he'd left, and the manager came down, and I said, did you see that? Huh? And he said, yeah. I said, he really lost the plot. You know, that's terrible. Yeah, but something you have to remember here, Tony, or you probably don't know, that he's after burying his wife there 2 weeks ago, and during the week he heard that his son has cancer. So, you know, the man was clearly irritated and that, probably because of grief and the other emotions, yeah. And I was maybe just happened to be in the wrong place, wrong time. And
I hope it wasn't your first day on the job, Tony.
No, it wasn't. But that's a great example of you kind of have to maybe speculate what else is going on in other people's lives.
Yeah, to have tolerance of people, because we don't know what they're going through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that given time. Okay, so just be cognizant of the time. I want to give you time to talk as well, Tony. So I might bring it over to your topic as well, and we can have a discussion about
sure,
that.
Sure, yeah. Thanks, Mark. Yeah, I'm going to touch a wee bit on trends and cycles. Now, my background is technology and retail. In fact, I have an electronic degree here, or diploma here in Dundalk. But so I have an interest in technology and that. And I'm in retail at the moment, and the store where I work has just rolled out brand new electronic card payment devices. And so somebody with these new debit cards, EIB and Bank of Ireland have them, that if you come up to a checkout and your goods is less than €15, if you just sort of hover your card over this payment machine, you hear a wee beep. Transactions done extremely fast. In fact, like what once used to be maybe 90 seconds is now down to 10 or 15 seconds, and just as fast as somebody paying with cash. So this is kind of we're starting to see the early stages of a new trend of people paying more and more electronically. I know that store where I walk in, there are payments, the payments is something like 25% to 30% now is either through a credit card or some kind of a debit card. So we're kind of seeing the early trend of electronic money. Some of you might have heard of Bitcoin. I don't know if yeah, I'm getting a couple of these are nodding ahead on that. The Bitcoin is kind of famed for being the first digital currency. And the people who got in at the very start have made a lot of money. Still very kind of controversial, and it's very popular among the tech people and geeks and that. Even this year, it was went through a controversial incident where apparently some company that was holding your bitcoins and that kind of, well, the management got a bit, walked away kind of, and left people, took their money and that. But something else that... we probably haven't really heard about what's going on behind the scenes, but there is US multinationals that's kind of looking at this and maybe moving, getting ready to move in, and big corporations that we heard of, Google. And in 2001, Google introduced Google Wallet. You might have heard about that. It's going on right now in America, getting very, very popular with the young people. And what they can do is they can put their credit cards or debit cards, say, on a smartphone, an Android or an iPhone like that, and they can go up to these new electronic card payments, and they can actually hover over and they can pay for their goods and services. Very popular with the young people and people like buying coffee and all that. And another company that we all heard of, Facebook. Well, Facebook now is right now in the final stages of getting a bank license from the Central Bank of Ireland. So you have Facebook and Google starting to emerge as bankers. And it sort of over time, it's going to take time to see how this is going to pan out, or who kind of wins, or maybe all three, Bitcoin and your Facebook and your Google, who's going to win, eBay or not eBay, but PayPal, which is a subsidiary of eBay. They've been doing ever increasingly transactions of online people paying through PayPal. You can nominate whatever currency, dollars, euros or Australian dollar, whatever like that. And this new technology is it's going to replace old technology, and so in the terms of money and that, it's going to replace the banks. So if we think of the bricks and mortar banks, we have to name a few, Bank of Ireland or AIB. So very possibly in the near future, we're going to see them sort of come under pressure. They're going to struggle to compete against the likes of these social media companies, because all the young people is totally signed up, familiar with them and comfortable with using their technology. So this term of an old or new technology replacing an old technology, it's called creative destruction. But the new technology would be creative, and then the other side of that, the destruction would be old companies going bust or not fit to compete. And a great example of this would be, on my way here to Dundalk, I went through Carrick, and as I was driving through Carrick, I was going, oh God, there's no phone boxes. When, I wonder when was the last phone box in Carrickmacross? When was it actually removed? Is there actually any phone boxes in any of the public streets in Ireland? Is there any in Dublin? I'm curious to find out. Like we all remember a phone box. I remember having to use them, getting off the bus from college and ringing home and be hoping that nobody would be in the phone box, because this would add to the lag time on getting a lift and that. So you have this is starting to sort of take off. It hasn't really hit mainstream, but it will, and it's looking like it's going to be very much part of our lives. And how it is going to affect the net jobs is going to be very interesting. There are some people arguing that the total net jobs of the compared to the new technology, compared to the old technology, will be negative. That this new technology will actually be reducing people's career, people's jobs and people's careers, but it's going to take time on that. If we take this a bit further, Google sort of made an announcement, or has been in the media and that, about a Google driverless car. They've been working on this now for nearly 10 years, and they have cars out testing them driving away, and some of the cars has actually over 700,000 accident-free miles. And a very famous investor, you might have heard of him, is Warren Buffett. And he's head of Berkshire Hathaway, that's his company. And a lot of their core business is around insurance. So here's a guy, a very smart, shrewd investor, and he's looking down the road and he's seeing possible threats to his insurance business. So if this driverless technology takes off and it proves itself that it's safer than human drivers, we're going to see maybe a huge drop in car insurance premiums in this, and companies not fit to compete and going bust. So that's the kind of the gist of this new technology and the creative destruction and that. So I'll invite you to make any comments or if you have any viewpoints on this. But I'll just finish off on this. The Olympics is in Japan, I believe, in 2020. And I think yesterday or the day before, the Japanese have announced that they're going to set up a robot Olympics. This will be a first time for automation and robotics to be competing. So, you know, this is new trends is starting, and they're very interesting and fascinating, and no doubt they'll have a huge impact in our life in years to come. So any comments or
It's very interesting. I'd definitely welcome that Bitcoin.
Bitcoin
that you're talking about. For the simple fact that I'm an absolute devil for losing things. Lost my bank card there recently in San Diego, so I got some money sent over to me. And then on the bus, then got it exchanged in Dublin Airport. And then on the bus from Dublin Airport back home, I left my wallet behind me. And because I'd taken out so much money, there was a good bit of money in that wallet. It was about €160. I got off at DKIT the last Sunday of May. So if anyone found my wallet and took the money out of it and left the wallet behind, and if you've got a bit of a conscience, you can always ring the radio. So I definitely welcome that Bitcoin. I'd be €160 up if they had them invented before the last Sunday in May. Well, not invented, but if I was using it. This is very interesting as well about the cars being safer to drive, perhaps, but definitely welcome that as well.
Like, I have a friend over in Galway, and he's working in a technology company, and they're working a couple of different technologies, but one of the things they do is small cameras in the rear of cars for now when people's parking and that. Yes. They can kind of see it on a screen and that. But even one step further than that, which they have developed and they've working examples, and I think they're doing trials with BMW and some of them other German automakers, is it will actually park the car for you, so you can get out of the car and say, command it to park the car. So, you know, this is all part of this technology, and it's coming together, and inside, I'd say 5 to 10 years, we're going to see it. But imagine no taxi drivers, no lorry drivers. The changes is just huge, like.
Yeah, and even, I suppose that would change Garda patrols on the road as well. If there's if a car's going to drive home for you when you've had a few in the pub, that's good.
Rural pubs could be revived.
Rural pubs could be revived. You get in the car and say, take me to the pub and leave me home again. I suppose that would, a positive to that was it would save a lot of organisations like the Gardaí. It would save their man hours that could be used elsewhere doing something, doing something else. So you know what?
But it's not going to speed too. Yeah. Your car won't really like speed. I'm sure like if you try to override it or that, it's going to send off a message to the local Gardaí station or whatever. Maybe drive you to the Gardaí station.
lock in with the seatbelt.
Stuff like that. Yeah, they already have kind of smart speed cameras that see if you know where to speak and slow down, but if you speed up in between to the next one, it can calculate the speed you were doing in between and still issue a ticket.
It will definitely make the road safer anyway, and we'll all welcome that. Just on that, we're nearly at 1 o'clock. I might leave you with the last song. Just it being an Irish band as well would stick with the...
A listener texted in about your story, Michael, about the lorry. They just said, did you make sure that your indicator light was working? I think you're insinuating be your fault.
I actually know. I checked that. I checked that after it. It did cross my mind, and it's something that I'm very particular about. I always look at the lights at least once weekly, and I did check the indicator, and it was working. But, you know, it could have been anything. It maybe... As I said, maybe the lorry driver just didn't see it. Maybe he thought, actually, to hell with this, I'm just going to drive it on. Maybe he was rushing somebody to the hospital. You wouldn't know.
Just think of this new driverless technology. That could be eliminated.
That could be eliminated, yeah. But then we'd miss comments like that from my friend, which are hilarious. Thanks to the listener for that, anyway.
Thanks, listener. And if any of you'd like to join us the first Monday of September at 8 in the fairways, you're more than welcome to come along for a look. We're under no obligation to talk. And we'd like to see you there. So with that, I'll leave you with the last song. Come On Live Long is the name of them. They're an Irish band, and I think they have a very pleasant sound, and they're going to be big, I'd say. You heard it here first. Thank you. Bye then.
It keeps holding on holding me.
You're listening to Conversations with Dundalk Toastmasters. If you would like to find out more about when we meet and what we do, call us at the station on 93 95 100, or visit our website, DundalkToastmasters.com. The Dundalk Toastmasters. We can help you improve your public speaking.
You are listening to a podcast from Dundalk FM, Dundalk's local community radio station. Do get in contact if you would like to find out how to join our team of sports, music, news and current affairs community broadcasters on DundalkFM.com, or find us on Facebook.